This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hello, listeners. You are on Joy 94.9, listening to Is Nothing Sacred. And tonight we're, you know, sticking to our usual cheerful topic.
Happy theme.
Happy theme. We're going to be talking about street violence, particularly focusing on the LGBTI community. So first up, I've got an interview that I did a few weeks ago with Bianca Philiborne from La Trobe University. And then later in the show, we'll be talking to Greg Atkins from the Anti-Violence Project. But as always, as usual, I'm here in the studio with James. Hello, James.
Hi, Steph.
And Jim. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Steph. Hello, James.
Hello, Jim. In the middle of an election campaign still, but
yes,
we are on more important issues.
39 days to go.
39 days to go.
It's a marathon.
I thought you were going to say in the middle of winter, it's got all cold and horrible. I was going to say May is my least favourite month, but I don't want to be too, you know, pessimistic. So, on that note, we would love to hear from you as always. You can SMS us on 0427 Joy949. That's 0427 569949.
Or even better, email us onair@joy.org.au.
Yes, indeed. Or you can call Robert on the front desk. The number is 1300 Joy949, which is 1300 569 949. So, here we have Bianca Philiborne from La Trobe University talking about the research she's been recently doing around street violence.
The project I've been doing has been looking at people who've experienced street harassment in Melbourne. Essentially, it's been looking at what sort of things do people experience, what are some of the impacts of those experiences, and how would people like street harassment to be responded to? Because one of the big issues at the moment is that, you know, some forms of street harassment are responded to by the criminal justice system, but a lot of it actually just flies under the radar and isn't responded to or just isn't reported. So, you know, how would people who experience this actually like it to be responded to by, whether that's the criminal justice system or, you know, more informal kind of responses? But I was also quite interested in looking at how people's, you know, gender, sexuality, living with a disability or being a person of colour, how some of those factors might also shape people's experiences and the impacts of those experiences.
Is it something that's quite common? Do we know how common it is?
Yeah, so certainly for women, we know it's very common. So with my research, people had to have experienced street harassment to take part, so it wasn't a prevalence survey. But definitely past research and international research shows that for women, it's incredibly common. So up to 90% of all women have experienced street harassment at some point in their life, and usually as a repeated experience. There's less data around on LGBT people specifically, but certainly the work that has been done suggests that it's, you know, quite a common experience to be harassed in public space and to be targeted specifically because of your gender or your sexual orientation. And certainly for the people in my study, you know, they were quite commonly experiencing street harassment. So most people were encountering it on a weekly or a monthly basis.
A weekly or a monthly basis?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
That's very common.
Yeah, that's right.
And are there different patterns with the different demographics with how women experience street violence compared to, say, LGBTI people or people within those communities?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of the broader categories of behaviours, there wasn't a lot of difference. So there wasn't any difference in terms of how commonly people experienced verbal comments or wolf whistling or car horn honking. But the intention behind that behaviour and the actual content of that behaviour tended to be different. So with verbal comments, for example, for, say, same-sex attracted or gender-diverse people, the comments were often quite explicitly about their gender or their sexuality, whereas for women it was more, or cisgendered women, it was more kind of sexualized kind of commentary. And likewise for, you know, people of colour or people with disabilities, often the abuse that they experience experienced quite specifically targeted those aspects of their identity or their self. So, yeah, there were definitely some differences. It also shaped the impacts of those behaviours. So, for example, for same-sex attracted people, if they were abused for, say, holding hands with their partner on the street or kissing their partner, then they became much less likely to, say, you know, show affection to their partner in public spaces. Or for gender-diverse people, they would often try and play down their gender diversity or try and look more cisgendered to avoid being abused. So it had quite profound impacts.
Yeah. That seems very unfair that the victim should have to change their own behaviour to avoid being victimised rather than focusing on the problem itself.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. And that was, you know, across the board, so for heterosexual women as well, you know, they would also quite profoundly change their behaviour in public space. You know, people changed, yeah, how they dressed, whether they went out alone. Some people stopped using public transport because they'd experienced so much harassment on public transport. So, you know, we're not talking about kind of minor consequences here. They were, yeah, like I said, quite profound effects on people's lives. And obviously for, you know, same-sex attracted or gender-diverse people, it was profoundly affecting how you can express a really core part of your identity and, you know, the extent to which you can do things that other people just take for granted.
Mm. And I think it's a really... like, it sounds like quite a clear expression of things that, you know, we, you know, myself as a woman and myself as part of the LGBTI community know that, like, sexism and homophobia is so pervasive. But I think sometimes people who don't experience those things don't realise how significant it is or how prevalent it is or what some of those impacts are. And even for people living in the inner city, like I know, actually one of my friends who was quoted in the BuzzFeed article talks about being on a train. And this is someone who lives in Brunswick. So it's not like we're talking that stereotype of like you're safe in the inner city and like out in the sticks, you're not. It can happen to anyone, anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, certainly for the people in my study, like it happened in all kinds of spaces. And, you know, some people did say, oh, you know, I moved from the country to the city and it got a lot worse or vice versa. But there was no real clear pattern in that regard. So, yeah, I think we definitely need to challenge the idea that it only happens in sort of certain pockets of the population or certain areas. It can happen anywhere. And it's definitely ignored and downplayed. I mean, for women's experiences, for example, we often hear that, oh, it's just a compliment, or they didn't mean anything by it, or whatever. Like, there's all this minimising and downplaying, and I think LGBT people's experiences are just completely ignored. I don't think they're really even, you know, on the kind of public agenda at all. So, you know, we need to start talking about it and challenging the idea that it's not serious, because for, you know, the people who I spoke to, it had, yeah, quite significant impacts and harms. So, yeah, it's not a compliment, and it's not, you know, it's not minimal in its impacts. Yeah.
I'm interested, you were saying before about talking to people about what kind of response they want, which is, you know, really great, because then we can get to those solutions. Were there trends in what people were asking for? What was it that people wanted?
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of variation. So people were quite supportive of the idea of introducing legislation specifically addressing street harassment. But it was a bit complicated. So people were saying, yeah, I'd like to see legislation introduced, and it would be really important in terms of expressing that street harassment isn't okay and that it's serious as a form of harm. But then at the same time, people were saying, but I don't really want to, say, like, have to go to the police or go through the criminal justice system or anything like that. The other challenge was that, you know, a lot of the harms of street harassment aren't necessarily just from individual incidents, although individual incidents can be harmful. A lot of the time it's also that repeated cumulative impact. So how do you actually address that? Because there's not necessarily like one perpetrator that, you know, you can have responded to. And then the other issue is that a lot of the time it's so fleeting and so quick that you don't even know who's done it, or, you know, they're already 500 metres down the road and you can't identify them. So there's also some practical issues. Then the other issue was, especially for LGBT people, you know, the police and the criminal justice system don't have a great track record in working with these communities. They haven't, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that they have, and Victoria Police in particular, have taken a lot of steps to improve. But that historical and current track record, you know, it does act as a barrier for people, you know, wanting to go to the police to complain about their experiences or to report their experiences, I should say. For a very small number of people, the police were actually the perpetrators of the harassment. So where do you go when that happens? Yeah, so there were quite significant barriers, I guess, to using a kind of formal justice response. So a lot of people were really focused on preventative and educational efforts, so actually trying to challenge and change some of those underlying and systemic factors that actually caused the harassment in the first place. So, you know, addressing homophobia, gender-based oppression and inequality were really key there, and challenging the idea that it's not harmful.
Mm. Connecting, representing, celebrating. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Hello, listeners. You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred, and that was an interview, if you've been listening, and with Bianca Philiborne from La Trobe University talking about street violence. So her project was looking at street violence more generally, but as probably won't be a surprise to many of our listeners, it is more common in the LGBTI community. In this next part, the second part of the interview, we had a bit of a chat about responses to street violence and what people wanted done. So here's part two of Bianca Philiborne on Joy 94.9.
When you were talking, it was making me think about what we can learn from the work that's been done around reporting sexual assault, and how, you know, everything is stacked against the victim in terms of the reporting and this proof, which how can you, you know, in this case where things often can't be proved. And so there's been conversations about shifting to more of a, like a model that's not adversarial. So I think there might be, I wonder if there's sort of things to learn from that. But then the other issues that you talk about, of course, with the fact that it's cumulative, the fact that it's just not one person, that it's systematic, that in most cases there's no way you can ever find that person again, makes it so hard.
Yeah, that's right. It's really challenging. And I think, yeah, that's definitely why we need to focus on the kind of higher level issues that are going on here. I guess the other thing that's probably really important to note in terms of reporting, that in Victoria we do have like the Anti-Violence Project, who will work with and support people who do want to report particularly homophobic and transphobic abuse to the police. So, you know, we do already have some good mechanisms in place. You know, I think we've seen some great advances in the violence against women field, like you said. So we could look at something like having a phone app where you can anonymously report incidents to the police, so there's at least some record there of it having happened. A number of people were embracing things like Hollaback and some of those online activist sites as well, and, you know, using that as a way of maybe not reporting but at least recording what's happened and sort of as, you know, proof or documentation that this happened, you know.
Because I guess maybe for some people there's sort of an element of validation that even if you can't get revenge or you can't get justice, something to sort of feel like, yeah, something has happened. And sort of a friend of a friend of mine, was probably over a year ago now, got assaulted in the street, and she chased the guy down the street and like took a photo of him and said something like, or, you know, something to make him turn around, took a photo, I think posted it on Twitter or Facebook, and it exploded and she ended up on Channel 7 News or something like that. And the guy got found and shamed, and obviously that's not a sustainable model but I guess it is an interesting example of like the evolution of this. And, you know, in that case she had got punched, so it didn't help the physical injury, but she won, I guess, in that sense of I mean, as someone who has occasionally experienced street harassment, that is part of the thing that you feel like you've lost if you don't do something. That, you know, someone yells at you, makes you feel crap, and then they're gone and you're like, damn it, I can't win.
Yeah, what can I do? You know,
what can
yeah.
I do?
Yeah, and like one person talked about, you know, reporting it on Facebook or Twitter or whatever as just taking back a little bit of the power. And I really liked that. You know, it's about reclaiming a bit of space for yourself and, yeah, feeling like you've done something. But sometimes it could also really backfire on people depending on where they were sharing their experiences. Some people got trolled and targeted for online abuse as well. So, yeah, it's definitely not an ideal mechanism or a perfect mechanism, but it could, you know, it could really help some people.
And with the anti-violence project as well, if people can report, because that's something I've used as well, that then you write it down and you can see the little dot on the map and you're like, that's my dot. It's there for people to see that this is real. It's like it's a tangible thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's proving that this happened, you know, yeah.
Do we have good examples internationally about how other people have dealt with this?
Yeah. So, yeah, we have seen some good examples in recent years, particularly in European countries who have introduced legislation, for example, mostly addressing verbalised sexual verbal harassment, but that legislation is quite recent, so we haven't really fully seen what the impacts of that have been yet. Some of the concerns with that type of legislation are that it could potentially lead to the over-policing and harassment of marginalised groups of men in particular, so men of colour, homeless men, young men. So, yeah, I think we need to sort of wait and see how it plays out. And then, of course, we just spoke about all the limitations of legislative approaches. And internationally, there's been quite a significant kind of grassroots activist movement. Mm. So we've seen the Hollaback movement. Mm. There's Stop Street Harassment that's come up in the United States and the Everyday Sexism Project in the UK. So there's really, I think, the kind of grassroots feminist movements are a really good example of how we can start to really challenge and get a bit of traction on this issue.
And I guess part of the thing as well is sharing understandings and getting a more common understanding of, well, as much as we can within the complexity of life, about what street harassment is and how, you know, some men, for example, if we use this sort of straight cisgendered man against a straight cisgendered woman model, where they might genuinely think that they are paying someone a compliment, or they might genuinely think that they are going to get a date with doing whatever it is that they're doing, which the woman finds quite, you know, offensive or stressful or...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sure a lot of the people perpetrating this behaviour have no concept that what they're doing is wrong, or just no concept of what it's like to have that kind of gendered experience in, or sexualised experience in public spaces, and what it's like to experience that on a kind of, you know, continued basis. Mm. So, yeah, I do think there is a lack of understanding. I think there's definitely need for things like respectful relationships, education, so we actually have, you know, some idea about how to ethically interact with our fellow citizens. And a lot of people in the project really overtly challenge the idea that it's, you know, oh, it's just a genuine romantic interaction, you know, because, I mean, firstly, if you really cared about someone, you probably wouldn't be, like, shouting at them out your car window or whatever. But also because there was usually such little regard for how the target of your, you know, affections is actually responding to them. So if it was meant as a genuine advance, you would actually care if they were, you know, reciprocating or not. So we definitely need to challenge that idea that it's, yeah, like a legitimate kind of romantic endeavour or something like that. So.
And I think there is good work, or I know there is good work happening around the world with, for example, the YWCA working and others working with teenagers in schools and with youth groups and through some church groups around consent and kind of these ideas that, of course, all interlinked, whether it's yelling at someone on the street or the way that people act in a relationship or after the relationship ends. And yes, we know it's all part of the same continuum of violence and care.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we're quite, you know, in Victoria, we're quite fortunate. So respectful relationships is now a compulsory part of the Victorian curriculum. We've had some really, I think, world-leading respectful and ethical relationships education developed within Australia. So hopefully that means that we do start to see some positive change, but it's always slow as well. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for talking with us.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and you are Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And we are such a happy bunch tonight because we're talking about street violence and things like that. And we've just been listening to...
Bianca Philiborne
from
La Trobe University. And if anyone's been listening and is finding it a bit hard, or if they've experienced street violence or just want someone to chat to, you can call Switchboard. It's 1-800-184-527. If you need a new pen, it's 1-800-184-527. And they are free, and you can call any time between 3 p.m. and midnight any night of the week.
And we now have in the studio with us Greg Adkins, who is the executive director. How's that for a swanky title? Of the Gay and Lesbian Anti-Violence Project.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you
Welcome,
very much,
Greg.
Jim. Pleasure to be
now,
here.
Now, you were just telling me that gay men are more highly numbered in the victimology of street violence. Is
certainly
right?
In our stats. We for midsummer this year, we analysed the last 9 years of data through the Anti-Violence Project, and gay men definitely spike out in terms of visibility to perpetrators of violence against us in street-based harassment.
Do you know why? What might be causing that? Is it something to do with the way that people perceive gender and stronger gender policing of men? Or
if you map it over the times of day where the violence takes place, it's usually evenings. It's usually Friday night, Thursday, Friday night, if it's a city-based assault. It's when your great unwashed from the outer suburbs come to Melbourne, come to town, go to clubs. They're probably people that are less exposed in their home, in the home places, to diversity. And late on a Friday night, you're
these
more likely...
These are the perpetrators.
The perpetrators. Yeah. More likely to encounter same-sex attracted men holding hands or, you know, walking down the street together than you are women in the centre of the city.
Mm. And probably a bit of alcohol thrown in on those particular times.
A lot of alcohol. And the common thing amongst perpetrators is men, groups of men, alcohol with groups of men, and then women that are with them, and they're all trying to... it's the masculinity argument. They're trying to be the more manly man. They're trying to be the leader, the king. They're trying to show off to her. And often the women become perpetrators themselves. So you have some women that like to be aggressive with their men partners, the straight men partners. So it's a really interesting mix of people that come from the outer burbs into Melbourne and cause most of the harm.
And can you tell our listeners a bit about the Anti-Violence Project and, I guess, the work you do to sort of play the role in tackling some of this?
Yeah, well, back in 1986, it was. 1986, way back then, I think I was the Beats project worker at VAC.
You were.
I was. And we had a fantastic team. It included people like Tom Carter, who was, you know, recently retired. Tom was part of our team as well. And we were going out and doing outreach to men in parks and gardens around
Melbourne. It means they were doing the Beats.
Well, they were doing the Beats. We were following
you
them.
You were doing the Beats as
with
well.
With the safe sex packs. And we had a huge spike in prejudice-motivated violence taking place in the Beats during that time, the whole time as a volunteer, and then became a staff member. And we pulled together a public meeting to talk about what we do about street violence right across the LGBT spectrum, and the reports we were getting through. Now, the Beats project were getting not just reports of men being victims, but we were picking up transgendered people who were victims of violence. And for them, the violence was... it was heightened. So if a gay man was bashed, the transgender person was bashed with an object. If a gay man was sexually assaulted during a violent assault, then the transgender person was assaulted with the object. I mean, it was heightened level of aggravated violence towards trans people. So we then went to the lesbian community, started talking about what was happening there, and we had a huge public meeting towards the end of November, December 1996. And it led to the formation at a public meeting on January the 20th, the next year, 1997, of the Anti-Violence Project. And next year's our 20th anniversary on January the 20th.
That's so exciting. Congratulations.
It was exciting. And we continue.
20 years.
Yeah.
And are you going to be celebrating somehow?
We won't be celebrating. We'll be acknowledging. And we hope to have every board member, every committee member, every co-convener, every volunteer that's been part of the Anti-Violence Project gather for a bit of a celebration. I think it's around about 300 people have been part of the volunteers that have kept the Anti-Violence Project going for 20 years.
And are the co-conveners all still active, or are they all been burnt out by this nastiness?
We've had... the dilemma is actually maintaining yourself and keeping yourself healthy to deal with people. And, you know, I was there at the start. There was a period of about 5 years when I backed away and just became a committee member for a few years, because it takes a toll when you're meeting people that have, you know, the rough end of the pineapple, and that's why they're making contact with you. Mm. It's hardly a celebration. I was reminded last week, Jim, when I went down to for Idaho. I was down in Ballarat speaking at an Equal Love event in Ballarat, and a man got up and said, "Look, I came here for a celebration, but all I hear is, you know, about violence and about negative stuff." And you're not going to find a celebration around what we do. Mm. We are meeting people when they're at their lowest. We're meeting people when they're most vulnerable, and they're even then some.
And but there is a place for celebration.
The celebration's about picking them up again.
Yeah. When people survive and become resilient, isn't it?
Survive and thrive.
Greg, I was going to ask that. I said, well, then, you know, there must be something that you do it for. There must be something that you get out of it. I suppose, is that something that's unique, that's different for everyone that is involved, or is it something that I suppose is a similar?
Well, I think I can only say what I get out of it. What I get out of it is a strong sense of achievement, a strong sense of making a difference. The number of people that we've been able to talk to our community, get the information, assist people to report where they wouldn't have reported. I mean, 7 out of 10 still don't report street violence, prejudice, crime. And where we've slowly chipped away and moved that from 1 out of 10 to 7 out of 10 over the last maybe 6-7 years, that's an incredible achievement. Tomorrow, when the apology takes place in State Parliament, when the formal state government apology for
people convicted... Do you think there'll be a spike after that?
I think the narrative changes for many people who have been the peers in our community to others and said, don't talk to police, don't trust them, don't report violence. Why would you go and trust the police? This is, and based on their experience, that narrative sort of shifts. And many of, Jim, the generation that remember the pre-1981 law change, people that were too afraid from their experience before 1981, that they will start now remembering their experiences and hopefully talk about what happened to them.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that apology that's happening tomorrow? What's the apology for?
Well, in 2014, we had bipartisanship from the Liberal government and the Labor opposition, and it brought in a piece of legislation that would expunge convictions for people convicted of crimes pre-1981 that no longer existed after homosexuality was made
legal. But people still had them on their records, and so if they tried to apply for a job, they had to say, yes, I've been convicted of a crime.
Well, if you wanted a visa to America, to USA, you'd have to declare that you had a conviction.
Or if you wanted a public service job.
Exactly right. And if you didn't declare it in some workplaces and they found out about it, you've lied on your application. So it meant for people immediately after 1981, they still had this fear of discrimination around their work and their employment. So for a lot of people, tomorrow marks a huge change. And for some people like the fabulous Noel Tovey and other people that have stepped forward with their stories, part of the 10 people so far have had their convictions expunged. For them, they will become advocates and leaders amongst many men that will now step forward, we hope, to have their records cleared.
And you were talking a bit before about police, and a few years ago the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer started with Victoria Police. Has that made a difference in terms of reporting of violence?
Oh, it's made a huge difference. I remember way back when we had an inspector that was the go-to point. Inspector John Winther was the go-to with the gay community and the police. And I hope John's listening, because he did nothing. Now, if John was to have a regret, I hope it's around the lack of action. But then think about the police force he was part of. We, way back when, 20 years ago, we had a homophobic police minister and we had a homophobic police chief commissioner. And I suppose anyone that was the token person to negotiate between our community and the police force was not going to have an easy road anyway, whether they wanted to or not. Then we had Jill Wood and David Truman that spoke about the Gay and Lesbian Police Employers Network wearing uniform, and the then police commissioner tried to remove them from the police force through the ethical standards investigation. Jill, a few years later, being allowed to wear uniform, she was actually one of the co-conveners of the Anti-Violence Project for about 4 years. So her involvement was more than just a police person. She had a vested interest in our community as a lesbian as well. Things have changed. We've had we don't just have one GLOW, because we went from we had Mel Edwards as the first GLOW. We ended up with Scott Davis as the second GLOW. Then Scott became...
And he was around for years, wasn't he?
He became then the manager of the Gay and Lesbian Advisory Unit of Victoria Police with I think it was Gabby Tyack came in as a GLOW.
But he's an ally, not a gay man, isn't he?
He's definitely an ally, yes. And you'll find most of the GLOWs, I think there's around about 65 GLOWs across the state now. And
there are also a number of quite senior out police. And I'm not going to name them on here, but a friend of mine is one of them. And, you know, when I was Director of Public Health, I used to work quite closely with him on public health issues. So there are people in there who actually understand the needs of the gay and lesbian community, and who've been able to influence, I think, by their just being there and being out in the police force, the culture.
Mm. They've had the leadership of people like, Christine Nixon was a fantastic leader. Simon Overland followed very well. And the most recently retired Chief Commissioner of Police was just fabulous. We've had
Ken Lay, he was very good, wasn't he?
Three excellent Chief Commissioners, now another one, a fourth one. You can never pack the old homophobic minister, Chief Commissioner of Police from 20 years ago back into the box. No one else will ever get that. Mm-hmm. The police force has changed. And our community, Jim, I think you might have been part of it, we've educated 6,000 out of the 18,000 police force with community encounters around how to appreciate difference and how to respect our diversity.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and it is now 16 minutes to 11, so we've already managed to get through three quarters of the show almost, and we're here talking about violence, public violence, really. Violence that occurs in public, not in the home or elsewhere. And we've got Greg Adkins from the Anti-Violence Project in the studio. Greg, do you get lots of support from other LGBTIQ organisations for this work?
Do you know, for a period of time, I think about 2 years, we were supported well by ALSO when they existed in the Pink Palace.
Well, that's a blast from the past.
But it was fabulous. We had shared meeting spaces. We had a pod that we could set up in. We're not funded, so that was really important in that part of our lifespan to be able to do that and to connect with all the other organisations here. It was fabulous. They went to God, unfortunately. And we're back out in six lounge rooms around the state. That's just the way it goes. But we're waiting with great anticipation for the Pride Centre and the opportunities that involves connecting communities and community organisations. It should be great fun. Though someone tweeted us recently, we look forward to coming along and sharing, doing the dishes with you. Well, if Sean Mulcahy from the Rights Lobby is listening, we'll do turns doing the dishes. But, you know, but we'll be having some great conversations, and it means we don't have to meet randomly every couple of months in a coffee shop. We'll be able to meet regularly.
But does the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby work really, really closely with you? I would have thought that would have been a natural ally.
They're the AVP, VAC and the ALSO Foundation actually were the key organisations that set up the Rights Lobby. So we were established before them and we were part of building them. And I think it was on the steering committee for the Rights Lobby when they first established. And that was important because we need to have groups that focus on lobbying. That's their job, because non-profits that lobby tend not to get funded for project work. So there was a distinction back there. Maybe it's blurred a bit now, but it was crucial that we have a lobbying organisation to get out there and sell the message. And then our role then would be to feed them the data, feed them the information, have that conversation about what was happening on the street and use that to inform what they were doing. So if you look at the Family Violence Royal Commission, the lobby did strong, solid community-based presentations and they connected with all the organisations that did the groundwork to produce those reports for the Royal Commission from our community.
And so are you represented on the Justice Working Group of the LGBTIQ Ministerial Advisory?
We're not. I think the structure of this is a bit different to the previous ones. We, in the former Labor government, I was on the Justice Ministerial Advisory Group then. This one's not a representative body. This has, the task force and its two working groups aren't representative. So
they're skills based, and one would have thought people working in the area would have been the sort of skills that they were drawing on.
Well, maybe that's different. It certainly doesn't connect to us in that way. We message members of those groups. We, if people ask us for information, we'll provide it, but we certainly don't have any representation on them.
It's very interesting you say about the distinction between lobbying and programs. And I'm also curious, we've been speaking a little bit over the last few weeks about queer history and sort of the narrative over time. And I guess I'm also interested to hear about how things have changed and now, working with people like Sean and Anna from the lobby about what you feel you can bring to them as younger members of the community, and maybe they can offer you yeah, in terms of that multi-generational dialogue?
Anna and Sean, look, they inspire me. Anna has these fresh eyes. So when she brings her vast legal experience, she's an amazing humanitarian lawyer, and when she brings that experience to the table, she also brings fresh eyes. So she travelled over to New York and met the people that do the anti-violence work there, looked at the Pride Centre, and she was able to come back with opportunities that we could only imagine we could do here, because she had fresh eyes looking at that. And she came back, and we've had some fantastic conversations, particularly with respect to prejudice-motivated violence and crime. And we wouldn't have had that without Anna's fresh eyes. I mean, one thing when you've been around in this patch for a while is we tend to get, your senses get a bit dulled. So it's good to have people like Anna and Sean, and the others, of course, the other co-conveners now from the Rights Lobby. It's very important to have them doing the work that they do for our community. Mm.
I heard someone say last week, you know, the pros and cons of someone saying, knowing what's been tried before, in that, of course, you don't want to keep going round and round in circles and making the same mistakes. We want to learn from our history, and that's why history is so important, and anthropology and archaeology and all those things. But also there is a place for people who sometimes say, we tried that before and it didn't work, but things are different now. On, you know, something like the Pride Centre, I'm sure 20 years ago that would have seemed... you know, maybe a pipe dream. And now
it did not.
No?
There are a number of us fighting for it in those days. And it's really just a culmination of a long struggle, I think, the Pride Centre, as are organisations like the Anti-Violence Project and the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. They're all things that that people are struggling for and trying to support. Greg, do you have the support of... the major pro bono legal firms?
We use 6 different firms to refer people to, usually based on who has the expertise in the particular piece of law that needs to be switched on for their case. It could be proximity to the lawyers, so they don't have to travel too far. But the most important thing with anyone that suffers street violence or prejudice crime or even relationship violence is... strike while the iron's hot. When someone comes forward and wants to communicate with us, we need to provide the information immediately, connect them with either police or lawyers straight away. If you don't do it straight away, they might not come back to you and have a conversation for 2 or 3 years. There's a delay in seeking help the second time. And
that's no different to most forms of domestic and community violence.
Exactly right. The hard part, though, is we're unfunded. We don't have paid staff. When they connect with us, we have to actually really pull the game up to make sure we help people or else we're harming them. And the beaut part about maybe looking for funding down the track and starting to do work that the current state governments allowed in the latest budget is we can respond more effectively, we can respond to a greater group of people, and we can do it quickly and right across the state, because we have representatives growing across the state in country and rural centres. So, you know, if you have street harassment in Warrnambool, why shouldn't you have the same access to supports in Warrnambool as you do in the middle of Melbourne? And that's our philosophy, have AVP right across the state in people's towns.
But isn't that that's the reason why having community connections, so the GLOWs, the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officers, are so important, isn't it? Because that does actually range across the state in police stations.
If you go to the Anti-Violence Project website, which is antiviolence.info, we map violence reports where they take place across the state. You can click on it and find out the narrative, the outcome. But you can also click on stars across the state and you can find your closest GLOW. You can find their phone number, their name, and that links to the police data in a much more accessible format than having to go and trawl through the police website.
Earlier in the show, when I was with the interview with Bianca, one of the things I was talking to her about, for anyone who was listening then, was about the satisfaction of putting that dot in. And, you know, I experienced quite, I guess, minor violence compared to some of the other experiences that people have. But it was enough to feel angry and upset and kind of rattled. And there's that feeling of you want to do something and you put that dot in and you... Like, for me, it definitely made me feel connected, like back connected to my community. So, yeah, I'm sure that so many other people would be feeling that same way, I hope.
Do you know, when Bianca released her report, it was a couple of weeks before, so the day before Pride March, we had a gay couple on the corner of Elizabeth Street and Collins Street that just had a quick cuddle, and a man ran across the road and started kicking them. The positives from that, the first positive is he gave his story to The Age. The Age published it in the same piece that Bianca Feilborn, Philip Bourne produced her research. And he, the victim, the principal victim, got a major sense of satisfaction about his story helping other people. And it was an incredibly cathartic moment for him.
This is often what people want, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. And the second thing for him that was cathartic was the perpetrator didn't realise that the young man he was attacking was a martial arts expert.
Oh!
So he was able to defend himself, which is quite rare in our community that we can actually defend ourselves from people. So the assault lasted just a matter of minutes instead of a longer period of time. And I think the perpetrator would probably think twice about attacking another gay man. Now, I don't recommend that, by the way.
No.
I don't recommend the best way of approaching street-related violence and harassment is to put some distance.
It's not to be a vigilante.
No, put distance between you and the perpetrator and just, you know, look how tall they are compared to the street pole. Look at, you know, get descriptions of them, their friends, and as soon as you can, call the police. Mm. And if you don't want to talk to the police, contact the Anti-Violence Project and we'll introduce you to the police.
Greg, sorry to go slightly more negative, but I mean, Jim mentioned before about potential spikes, and I mean, I suppose we might, I don't know what your view is, whether we'll see more of that, particularly because we are having a steady march in progress on these issues, but we do seem to have see pushback with things like safe schools and, you know, I just wonder with things coming up like the plebiscite and things like that, whether you think that they, do you see a spike in violence and things like that around those times?
There's definitely a potential for a spike around the plebiscite. When you fund homophobes to have a paid spot at the lectern to print their materials, to distribute it, to G up the people, that it takes a little bit of momentum to activate other prejudiced people, that is an incredibly harmful situation, I think, for many people. Mm-hmm. And we have a huge group of LGBTI people, perhaps LGBT people, that have lower resilience and are less connected and have less supports than the people that are going to be on the other side of the argument around equality. Mm. And for them, as a community, we're going to have to lift. We have to lift and embrace the most vulnerable in our community rapidly if the plebiscite goes ahead. And each one of us, all four of us in this studio and everyone listening, we have a responsibility, if there's a plebiscite, to embrace the others in our community so that no one's harmed by this horrible opportunity that the homophobes have.
Don't worry, we will be talking about it on this show, that's for sure.
Yeah. And just a reminder, if you're listening, and you can contact the Anti-Violence Project, or you can also contact Switchboard, which is 1800 184 527, and you can call them about anything if you need some support, if you're in the community. They are available from 3 p.m. to midnight. And I think it's time to say goodbye.
Oh, it's been a pleasure being here. Thanks so much for talking about our project.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you also to Bianca Philiborn, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, who you heard earlier in the show. Do you want to give a quick spruik for how people find the Anti-Violence Project?
Go to the web, antiviolence.info, check out Facebook, VicAVP, or just email VicAVP at antiviolence.info or Greg at antiviolence.info.
Excellent. And I think hopefully everyone now has something positive they can take away from this, and as you say, we have to stick together. That has brought us to the end of the show.
Was fast, wasn't it?
It was pretty fast. Hmm. Yes.
We know we've had an important issue when that happens.
Yes, time has vanished.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.